Hi, I'm Molly Wood. This is The Source Code. You see, lots of interviews we do for Marketplace Tech go way longer than we have time for on the radio or, honestly, even on the podcast. And sometimes these people are so noteworthy or brilliant or both that the people who are super into them will want to hear the whole thing. And that's what this is, a very lightly edited interview that lets the original source shine. This is Nick Bostrom, the director of the Future of Humanity Institute at the University of Oxford. He also wrote a book called Superintelligence: Paths, Dangers, Strategies. And he's the guy who back in 2003 came up with the hypothesis that we might all be living in a computer simulation. So sit back, relax, and prepare your brain for the source code. So I feel like I've been talking about transhumanism, or the conversation about that has really been from the physical perspective for a long time. Now it's starting to shift, and certainly you're looking at it, or seem to be looking at it, from an intelligence perspective. Is that fair to say that that's sort of the evolution of transhumanism right now?
And that's always been the part of it that has interested me the most, the intelligence and other mental dimensions.
Tell us, if you wouldn't mind, about the difference.
Well, I mean, the idea of if you could take some doping thing and you can run 2% faster, you know, it's hard to get really excited about that, partly because it's a positional good. And a lot of physical enhancements would be positional good, aside from health. Partly also because it seems more peripheral to what gives value to life, whereas what we experience seems very central to the value that we get out of life and to our ability to make a difference in the world. It's much more. So I think that, yeah, the kind of things that could change the substrate of thinking, the substrate of experience, has always been the part of transhumanism that I have found most interesting, along with extension of healthy lifespan, which I do think is another sort of fundamental dimension.
What is could you define a positional good?
Well, it's a good that that benefits one person, but as it were, at the expense of another, something that you have relative to another. So take the case of an athlete running in the Olympics, and they figure out some way to enhance their running ability. So now they get the gold. Maybe that benefited them, but it means somebody else who would otherwise have won the gold now has to make do with silver. Mm-hmm. So the net effect of everybody being able to run a little faster is zero. There is still going to be just one gold medal. Mm. So one person's gain is another person's loss. Now contrast that with something like health. If you get healthier, I'm no worse off. We can both get healthier. We are both better off. So I think that there is really no moral case for trying to push forward with enhancement technologies that provide merely positional goods. Whereas if they provide intrinsic benefits, then I think there is a prima facie moral case in favor.
Although certainly plenty of people have argued the kind of long-term downside of people either living longer or living effectively forever, at least from a population perspective, right?
And I think there is a double standard here. So when we are talking whether somebody should try to figure out the better chemotherapy for somebody who has kidney cancer or something, there seems to be pretty much universal agreement that that's a good thing to do and to try to make progress. And the same thing if you figure out a better way to prevent strokes or heart disease or treat diabetes or for any other particular cause of sickness, disability, and death, we think it's great if it's eliminated. And yet when you add it all up and ask people, oh, should we try to extend a healthy human lifespan, and then you get more divergent views. Hmm. But it seems to me that the case for favoring healthy life extension is precisely the same as the case for favoring better treatments for all these specific things that cause us to die and get sick. And to really make progress on that, probably you would have to ultimately do something about the aging process itself, since that is the cause of most sickness, most disability, and most death. It's because you get frailer as damage accumulates in your cells, and eventually you sort of keel over and die. But rather than just putting out the fires one by one, it seems better if you could deal with the underlying increase in frailty that tends to occur as we grow older.
So let's get back to intelligence, since that is the topic of your book. How do you see artificial intelligence playing into super intelligence? Do you imagine this people being able to enhance their own intelligence using machines?
Well, so there are a number of possible routes that could lead to super intelligence and any form of general intelligence that vastly outstrips current human intelligence. So you could imagine enhancements to our biological cognitive capacities through maybe genetic selection or genetic engineering or some other method. Or you could imagine artificial intelligence getting there first. To some extent, it's an open question whether the biotech route or the AI route will first bring us super intelligence. Ultimately, though, I think machine intelligence just has a vastly higher potential. there are fundamental limits to information processing in biological tissue, such as our brains.
You have argued that, you know, when we talk about artificial intelligence, that we humans are like children playing with a bomb. You know, there are plenty of good business cases being made for an increase in the abilities of artificial intelligence. Do you think that that's something that's likely, the economic push is something that's likely to set that bomb off sooner?
Certainly. I mean, there are a lot of reasons for pushing forward with AI research. One of them, increasingly, is the commercial relevance of this technology. There is also, and has for a longer time, been sort of scientific curiosity driving this forward, and spillover from other scientific disciplines like statistics, computer science, neuroscience. But for sure, now the forces driving this forward are very strong and getting stronger.
And people really disagree about the timeline. And of course, on some level, the threat. You know, you've argued we're playing with a bomb. Elon Musk and other technologists agree. Then there are people like Andrew Ng, and engineers doing AI research who are saying, look, we're hundreds or thousands of years away from such an eventuality. What do you think is the possible timeline?
I can't actually think of, I can't remember anybody who thinks it's hundreds of thousands of years. I guess there are some that think it might never happen. But we did a survey of some of the world's leading machine learning experts last year. And one of the questions we asked was, when do you think there will be human-level machine intelligence or high-level machine intelligence defined as AI that can do all jobs, at least as well as a human? And well, depending on how you ask the questions or so, usually the median answer to that is about, it's a 50% chance by 2045. And you're right that opinions are all over the place. There's certainly nothing like a consensus. Some people are very convinced it will happen much sooner, and others are convinced it will take a lot longer. But it's still interesting to note that, for what it's worth, the sort of the average AI researcher thinks that there's a very sizable chance of it happening within our lifetimes.
What does that mean for work? I mean, if you project out, you know, less than 50 years, will work be sort of a hobby of sorts for humans? Will there be other kinds of jobs that machines don't do? What might that look like?
I think that what you get at that point, after you have machine superintelligence, is that humans become sort of superfluous for any purpose where you measure the performance by some objective characteristics. So the machines will be able to perform all tasks better than humans can. Now, does that mean that there is no work left for humans to do? Well, if consumers, for example, have a preference for products made by humans, then there could still be a niche for that. Just as some people today will prefer to buy products maybe made by hand or made by indigenous people or made by some special favored group. So if there are consumers in the future who have those preferences, then there might be jobs for humans. Or if there are reserved sectors, maybe only humans are allowed to serve as judges or legislators or so forth, that could be jobs for humans in those domains. But by and large, though, I think that if this turns out well, and assuming we sort of can have a controlled detonation so that the machines do what we want, then we would be moving into a different era where we hopefully don't have to work for a living. And our role there, I think, is to enjoy all of this. And we would have to rethink a lot of our values that are kind of now based on the idea that you're a fully worthy human being only if you're contributing economically and bringing home a paycheck and so forth. But all of that would have to be rethought.
So human work almost becomes a luxury good or like an artisanal product, like made in the USA, made by humans.
Yeah, and it's quite difficult to know whether there would be a well, how big that niche would be. One factor here is that in these scenarios where really machines do become able to do everything we can do, you'd have very rapid economic growth. So the returns to capital would be enormous. So if some of the people owning that capital do happen to have this preference for these kinds of distinctively human labor, then there could be quite a lot of demand for that. If you had multi-trillionaires who just happen to have a lot of humans doing things for them, then that could in principle be enough to provide a lot of jobs. But it seems that maybe a more attractive solution would be to have even a relatively small degree of redistribution, where if the pie grows enormously larger, then even a small slice of that could go a long way to giving everybody a secure income. Unless, of course, you have too much population growth, in which case ultimately you fall back to a kind of subsistence level income.
And would you say that machines then become competitors, colleagues, or is there also the possibility that we will become increasingly machine, maybe through the sort of neural interlace technology that we've heard Elon Musk talk about?
So how it plays out then depends on how well we manage this transition to the machine superintelligence era. It's not clear what the outcome will be. So maybe some of the work we are doing now, some of the research into the AI alignment problem could make a difference, make it more likely that we will end up with machine superintelligence that is on our side, that is sort of an extension of the human will, that's friendly to us and safe, as opposed to some alien antagonistic force that ultimately overwhelms us.
And of course, you say that's assuming that everything goes well, that we have a controlled detonation. What does the other scenario look like?
Right, right. So I think there is like a sequence of problems. Like, so in order to get the privilege of confronting this question of meaning and employment, we first have to make sure that we solve the technical AI alignment problem.
Right.
So that we don't have some AI going off making paper clips out of the whole planet because it happened to be misprogrammed with the goal of just wanting as many paper clips as possible. So if we solve that technical problem, then we kind of get to confront the economic problem. And if we solve that too, then maybe we get the privilege of confronting the meaning problem of what to do with the leisure that you have and the wealth that you have.
Nick Bostrom is the director of the Future of Humanity Institute at the University of Oxford. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.